Welcome back, folks, to episode 59 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast with me, your host, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. For today's discussion, what we're going to discuss is a principle that states, don't make any mistakes you can't afford. Also, we're going to be discussing how data isn't always skewed and how self-confirming bias tends to get in the way of things when we're trying to interpret data. And also, we're going to be discussing feedback. And the term and quote I'd like to use is from the late Dr. Glenn Morris's book, Path Notes of an American Ninja Master, from 1994. Amazing book, but where he states that feedback is the breakfast of champions. So to start the discussion, what we're going to do is go back to the principle of don't make any mistakes you can't afford. Don't make mistakes you can't afford. It doesn't mean don't make any mistakes, but this is a way of looking at things whenever we're going into a situation, when we're planning for a project, whenever we're dealing with day-to-day social level interaction type life details. We have more information going for us than we do not knowing what it is that's going on. Sometimes we enter into situations in which we have certain things covered, and that is how I'm arriving, how I show up, what my ability is to manage unknown factors or the unknown generally. Unknown, in quotes, can become a very big, hairy, scary thing. But when we're discussing going into unknown territory, it could be a social environment, it could be an event in the natural day-to-day sense, or you could be going into the woods, you could go into a jungle, you could be going into a city or town or environment that you don't know the way, but there's some things that are known. One is how you arrive. How much information do you know? Do you know how to speak the language? Do you know the area? Do you know what you're looking for? And also having some sense of direction provides us with some fundamental notes that often are overlooked when we're problem solving. We tend to ask what we don't know first versus taking an audit of sorts, a self-audit of what I do know. What am I coming to the situation with? My wherewithal, my knowledge, my experience, my ability to problem solve under pressure. And maybe what I do know is that I have, for instance, if I'm going somewhere, in my vehicle, I have food just in case I break down or have to stay somewhere overnight. Also, I may have water just in case. Also, have an emergency pack, and I have enough fuel to get me from point A to point B. Those are some solid details. So back to the principle of don't make any mistakes you can't afford. When we're interacting with somebody or an event or even for that matter, project management, where you may be dealing with people, where you have to negotiate. Knowing that you have the skill to communicate in a way that is amenable, where we can get along in a sense, to where there may be some trade-off and there may be benefit to both. Knowing that in any negotiation, there has to be some sort of benefit to come to an agreement. Or if there's a disagreement or break-off of communication, we know that the costs are too high to one side or the other, maybe both, that may create a breakdown in communication where rapport cannot be developed, which is trust in communication. And also that whatever it is that is being negotiated about maybe is so valuable that any potential loss of that value or leverage for that matter could be causing problems in the future. And the idea is that the principle states, don't make any mistakes you can't afford. It is also done with the presupposition of you know things, not just the self-knowledge or what you bring with you, your assets and your resources, but also what will I be impacting moving forward. In a self-regulatory sense, as far as how I control myself, self-control, what one says, not being offensive, trying to be not necessarily overly socially appropriate, and maybe avoiding being too accommodating, but rather staying in a balanced sense so that way you don't look weak as if you're trying to seek or even beg for that matter versus coming into a situation where you're overpowering and too strong, and that can also break down communication. So what are the mistakes that I can't afford is the question that I need to ask myself. And these are the things that we start knowing and weighing what it is that I have to gain or seek to gain if there's a negotiation happening, but also what is it that I'm at risk for losing by negotiating, and then by trading off equally, will I be able to get the benefit? Notice the self-direction of these questions, but also a self-assessment going forward, because it's not guaranteed until we can get to a point where there is trusted or rapport type communications occurring. So what is a mistake that I can afford making? Sometimes not knowing information can give us flexibility and response, in the sense we may respond to things more spontaneously and be willing to be authentic, more authentic, by allowing the person we're negotiating with or maybe interacting with to educate us a little bit and feed us a little information if that is the case. And they may be forthcoming if it's not a really risky situation. If you're asking directions, for instance, by allowing somebody to show you what direction and asking them and telling them thank you, being socially appropriate and giving the common courtesy, often that goes a long way. Sometimes just a smile and appearing friendly, not an inauthentic smile, not the salesman smile. Sorry to you salesmen out there that like to use that tool, but one that stems from truly being authentic and seeking assistance, and that power play is not occurring, but rather one of meeting in the middle, so to speak, where there's an equivalence, a social equivalence, where there's no threat. And these all tie into the biological, environmental essay that we take moment to moment whenever we're taking in information at the subconscious level at 3 million bits of information versus 3,000 bits per moment that we're consciously managing what it is that's going on. So lots of information coming in. So what are the mistakes that I can't afford is the question. And how do I get to the point where I can get those questions filled? One is by avoiding conflict or avoiding appearing aggressive, how one presents. That can help us avoid some of those problems. So notice that even the way I formulated these statements, they're indicators of what to do versus what not to do. The what not to do's are some of those mistakes that you can't afford, appearing aggressive or overpowering. And sometimes that can be very off-putting, sometimes speaking too loudly, too abruptly, or maybe even jerky motions, because for certain cultures and certain people, abrupt motion, if you're in a place where people concealed carry firearms, moving too quickly can actually cause somebody to respond in a way that may seem defensive, and we have to be careful with that. So being at ease versus being ill at ease, that's the problem that one cannot afford to have whenever one's dealing with unknowns. So being as calm as possible, knowing what it is that you're asking, being aware of what you're asking, and knowing what your goal is, finding out, well, where to go, how do I get there? So that is kind of a description of how to use the don't make mistakes you can't afford. It doesn't mean don't make any mistakes, because in the process of learning, mistakes will occur. So those are mistakes that you can afford and practice. In martial art, you make your mistakes in practice, because if you practice well, you won't bleed in the street, so to speak. And by learning how to do these things in low pressure, low stakes situations, one gains skills. So that way, when it becomes more careful, one doesn't make mistakes one can't afford, things that are going to be high cost, high value mistakes that are irreparable or hard to get back. So the next part of this is going to be skewed data. So not all data that we hear is comforting and warming to my heart and comfortable. And that's an important thing to note. Sometimes we hear things that are very absolutely black and white, concrete, up and down, and very little room for interpretation. And it's not always something that is, once again, a comfort to us. But whenever we're speaking about what makes me feel good, then we have to look a little deeper and understand, what belief do I hold? What thoughts do I have? What concepts do I value? Or if we, in this case, it's going to be, what lens do I use to look at this problem with that makes me look at the data as either good or bad, where I judge it and I have a predisposition to looking at it a certain way? What are the ideas that I hold or beliefs that I may have? What are the trainings that I have? My conditionings, as it were. How was I brought up such that I see things a certain way? We see a lot of this occur whenever we're discussing differences in religion and what is being proffered in the news now about racial tensions. Not that there are more now, but they're trying to sell it to us as if there is. And being able to determine where that bias is, trying to look at the information the way it is, understanding what the legacy media does, for instance, gives us an insider's view without taking the bait, being able to recognize and acknowledge the bait, of course, know that those things are being put out there for a reason and there is an agenda, but it may not be yours. It may not even match your beliefs. So looking a little deeper, doing a little research, absolutely required and incredibly helpful, and I certainly encourage you to do that. So what is it that makes me feel a certain way about data? Well, some of us don't like dishonesty. That is one thing, and that is a value. I like honest communication. I don't like people lying to me directly or manipulating or pushing an agenda, and especially if it's one that is harmful to people or that is sold in a way to us or shown to us in a way that makes it look like it's a popular idea when in reality it's not. Now, whenever we're looking deeper at things, this is where we start questioning whether or not data is solid or not. Doing your own research when it comes to actual numbers and stuff, stats, it's going to vary. And if we understand what statistics are, and I love this quote, that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And this just indicates that statistics, those numbers that were being shown, often are within a very limited group that are being proffered and generalized to larger populations. This is something that if you do any research, which I have in my academic career, done lots of research, wherever I've had to study to write papers and things of this nature, and noting that even within the scientific community that there are certain skews or directions or agendas being fulfilled with whatever numbers are being proffered as a result of a study, knowing that there are certain numbers that are more applicable to larger populations based on how big the samples were. And if you have something that came out of a very small sample size, not as generalizable, but still important information, but definitely not the equivalent of something that would be an experimental type of study, where experimental is probably the strongest one that we have, especially if it's a double-blind study. And also over something that's just showing a correlation or relationship that says, wow, when this happens, this occurs. There's definitely a big difference in what it is that we're reading and how those numbers are interpreted and what the strength of those numbers are. Now, even then, an experimental study may bring about certain results, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they're giving you the whole data set. They may have a whole mess of numbers ranging from the lowest to the extreme highest, and they only give us supposedly the middle, but it may not even be the true middle because they may cut out the outliers, the things that will make the bell curve a little crooked, or wherever there are two bell curves in your data set. That's called a multimodal distribution for those stats nuts out there. Love you guys. And whenever we have that, we know that there's a difference in what it is they're pulling up, and naturally the distribution came out that way. So does that mean that they're lying to us? Well, not really. What they're doing is showing us the data that supports what direction that we're researching anyway. And they may have shown some trends, but those trends may or may not be indicative of a bigger process. Without getting too far in the weeds now, why is this important? The data that we receive sometimes isn't always the data that they tell us it is, in quotes, because they may be trying to extrapolate a certain bit of it and trying to make it sound overly generalizable to everybody and their mom, when in actuality, it may just apply to the moms and moms only, not everybody else. And that's a specific population within a population that may have come up that they're focusing on to make it sound like the numbers are bigger or better than what they are. So just some important points there. Beyond that, so what is it that is the import of knowing data? Well, data is data. Let's just assume is good data, good solid data is mostly reliable. Let's say 80% reliable. And that's okay. 1 in 4 is chance. That means anything of 25% or less falls within that quartile is not particularly reliable, but it is an effect, one that we can look at and say, okay, that happened, and that may be an interest that one can study on later, but it's not as frequent nor as, I would say, influential as something that occurs 80% of the time versus 1 in 4. But there's something there still, so it's not something that's absolutely negligible. So whenever we look at data, we have to make sure that we check ourselves. And this is the last part of this discussion, and that is our self-confirming bias potential. When we look at data and we like it and we have certain feelings and opinions about it, and we start having these projections in the future, thinking with this data, then we have used our filter, our self-confirming bias, that may move us in one direction or another, maybe as a result of experience or belief, an individual experience. If I were to put that into a scientific study, that would be considered an N of one. Your N is your population, and your one would be you. And this means my anecdotal experiential data doesn't mean that it's not somehow useful. It is. It's just not great for generalizing to all the population. But if you have enough N's of one that are speaking the same thing, then as much smoke, there's fire. There's got to be something there, and maybe something worth studying. But my bias, my personal filter, the way I see the world, the way I believe things to be, my expectations, and how I project into my future based on how I expect things to be based on my experience, that is what we're questioning here. What is my bias? The next rational question would be, if I have a bias, what data that is reliable and useful am I dismissing? Am I judging as a negative or something that I can't use? Or what data am I using that I'm endorsing maybe more than I should? Maybe I'm taking as a more positive spin than what the actual data supposedly holds within its confines. So these are really important things to not only recognize, but also understand, to be able to step back from data, step back from opinions and from having emotions right away. I believe about two episodes ago, 56, I was talking about using the suspension of emotion technique, wherever we do a breathe out before I start making any judgments at all. By having that breath out, that also solidifies us and prepares us for impact, as it were, in a physical sense, and that I consolidate my torso in the environmental sense if something's going to attack me. Inhaling and getting hit when you're all wobbly and weak is a bad thing for your spine. But by consolidating one's torso, not getting tense, but just exhaling out, that puts you in a sense of more centered, grounded feeling in the body. But also, it keeps one from judging immediately based on the emotional rise or maybe even a surprise. If you're surprised, you don't want to suck wind, you want to exhale. It's a very useful tool. But whenever we're identifying where my bias is, and am I biased more towards the positive, what could be incorrect and inaccurate at some point as judging something negatively or bad, the idea is to be as centered as possible and to take the information that we're bringing in, whatever data set we may be looking at or experience that we're experiencing, and not judging it emotionally, but rather looking at it the way it is and how things are unfolding, which is going to take you a lot further into the survival scale, whether it be in the social dynamic, wherever you get accepted and maybe make a good deal that's been negotiated, and maybe even actual survival in the physical sense, where you may be avoiding something being thrown at you and hurtling through the air and being able to duck, or determine whether or not someone's really trying to harm you, or is that dog really friendly? Is it really smiling at me, or is it going to bite me? Knowing the difference between those things and not having an emotional reaction, but rather being as centered as possible without allowing it to become a personal affront to your ego and how you believe. So that, in essence, in a nutshell, has to do with the three things we're going to be discussing today that are very useful tools. Not making mistakes that you can't afford is a great principle. Also knowing that our biases, our internal biases, can also skew the data. And it's not always the data that is particularly skewed. We may have solid data. And knowing where to see the skew in the data is an important thing. And also knowing that whenever we're receiving information and going into the unknown, some of the things that give us the best and most leverage is self-knowledge. What do I have? What do I bring with me versus looking at things that I don't have, that I haven't acquired? Don't forget what you carry with you. Don't forget what you bring with you. Don't forget that you have the most powerful tool in the world, and that is housed in your brain. That's your mind. And the more centered you are, the more equanimical you are, the way you look at things without judgment. That is one of the best self-regulatory skills that you can apply on a day-to-day basis that'll never stop serving you. So that's all I have for today. I just want to tell you thank you for spending some time with me today, and I hope that you share this podcast with people. We're available on all platforms where you get your podcasts, and we're also available on YouTube. If you want to check out my audio podcast on YouTube, it's exactly what I have recorded on Buzzsprout and Amazon, but just look them up there. Share them with people that you know that you think might benefit, and I certainly would appreciate it if you have any feedback to send me. Remember, feedback is the breakfast of champions. I want to get good. I'd love to be a champion one day. And the only way I can get that from you is by sending me an email. Send it to runningmangetskillsproject@gmail.com. And I'd love to hear from you once again. Take care. Have a great day and walk well.